Hello and welcome to the podcast from That's Not My Age. I'm Alison Walsh. I'm a journalist, author and blogger, and I'd like to invite you to join this conversation. I'll be interviewing lots of brilliant people about life and style and getting older. It's a grown-up guide. Hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the That's Not My Age podcast. Today I'm delighted to introduce our first MP. It's Stella Creasy. Stella, hello.
Hey, Alison, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Good, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Oh, just to explain, Stella is the MP for Walthamstow in London, a champion of women's rights and much, much more. So, Stella, you started out as an MP in 2010. How did you first get into politics?
Oh, goodness, I got involved in politics much earlier than that. And I think my parents will always regret having said to me, well, what are you going to do about it? When I said to them, I thought the world was unfair, not least because they live in the constituency I represent. So they have to put up with me as their MP now. But I was always very heavily involved in various social issue campaigns, always very concerned about injustice. I mean, I must have been a total pain in the ass to teach at school. I really must have been. And I had a kind of light bulb moment because bear in mind, I was living in Essex in the 1990s. So to be fair, I thought that me, Billy Bragg and my parents, that was about it for socialism in a kind of 500-mile radius. So it hadn't really occurred to me that political parties were a good thing. You know, the government was the enemy and the campaigns I was involved in, it was very much about taking them on, as you do when you're 15 and convinced that you know what's right in the world. I had a kind of light bulb moment where there was an issue, and this really ages me to talk about it, but live animal exports. And we were seeing crates and crates of very distressed sheep being exported from the port at Brightlingsea. And me and a lot of my friends at school were very upset by this and campaigning on it and saying that this shouldn't happen. And I mean, my dad was involved in the Labour Party just as a local activist. And I sort of was aware of kind of Labour and Tory, but he said, well, you know, one of the things that the Labour Party is saying is, you know, we would stop the port being used. And I was like, guys, look, we can achieve what we want to achieve. And all my teenage friends were, no, it's much more important that we stand on the dock and shout at sheep at 6 o'clock in the morning. Now, possibly because I wasn't the greatest at getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, politics seemed like a more productive place to make change happen. And you know, in my head, I'm still that 15-year-old burnished with injustice at the world and excitement about what could be achieved. But I also have seen now that politics can do good as well as bad things. And so, I mean, I was a youth worker. I helped run a charity. I did all sorts of other things before I became an MP. But ultimately, when the place I was living in, London Walthamstow, which I've lived here now for 28 years and I adore it, when the MP said he was standing down, I'd already been a local councillor by that point, and I couldn't have done anything but put myself forward. And that was longer than that. Was 16 years ago that people selected me to be the MP. So it was a very long and roundabout process of staying, but basically, if those sheep hadn't been treated so badly, I wouldn't be here today.
Oh, how is it having your mum and dad as constituents? Do they turn up at your, do they turn up at your surgery at the weekend? Because when you haven't popped round for Sunday lunch.
What happens is I'll meet people because, I mean, my mum and dad are amazing people who have devoted their lives to helping others as well in all sorts of other ways. But that means I meet people who say, oh, I was going to come and see you, but I met this woman because my mum helps run the local night shelter for the homeless, for example. She was a special needs head teacher. She's now retired down to London and she lives here. And she said, don't worry, I'll have a word with her about that. And they've met my mum. So and my dad, still involved in the Labour movement here.
They're helping you out.
which doesn't really... I'm not sure how people sort of know how to treat it when they see, you know, me and my family kind of saying, no, you're wrong. But we are very close as a family, but also completely capable of taking the piss out of each other. So my mum, when she first got involved in social media, didn't realise that other people could read it. So she was writing all sorts of things about me on Twitter. Or she'll say to me, which probably pertinent for your podcast. You know, she'll text me and she'll say, I saw you in Parliament today. Do you want me to book you a haircut?
Thanks, Mom.
So they are, you know, there's probably pride buried in there somewhere, but there's quite a lot of piss taking.
Well, like all families, I think most families are like that. So 2010, and then, you know, how have you found the last 13 grim years?
Well, it's one of the things I think is really important about this role, right? And I have it in my Twitter bio that sitting on the sidelines is a Stabler and Waldorf because I was a big Muppets fan as a kid. I want a Labour government. I'm obviously very partisan about that. But I don't think you have to wait until you get into office to fight for the power of your ideas. So, I mean, I've spent the last 13 years being a kind of guerrilla campaigner on various issues. But because I still feel that 15-year-old on me saying, well, this is just wrong and it has to change and why aren't we doing something about it? So absolutely, you know, it is frustrating to watch a government do things. Because when I was, 1997, I was 20, in fact. And it was a big shock to me to suddenly get a government that I kind of thought was going to do good things, because that had always been a sort of slightly theoretical thing. And I still remember Tony Blair standing in the Aylesbury estate saying, we're going to end child poverty, and thinking, crikey, he means it. And so, you know, the last 13 years of watching things, like I'm not here to defend the last Labour government in any sort of sense, in terms of like it was all wonderful, but there were things that really mattered to me. So things like child trust funds, which I could just see were opening up opportunities for kids in the community that I represent. The Sure Start, just the way in which the NHS has been stripped to the bone. I'd been a local councillor. When I was a local councillor, I talk to my councillors now, you know, we were arguing about where to invest and the pace of investment. Every conversation I have with my local councillors now is about what more, you know, where else can they find cuts, because there's so, you know, the money they get from government has gone. And it has been grim. But within that process, you know, one of the other things my mum always says to me is like, it's not about you. And she's absolutely right. You know, you cannot let how you're feeling distract you from what could be done here. And I think that's the thing that's kind of wound up Conservative MPs and whips, but also kept me going, is that sense that actually it doesn't have to be like this. And so we don't have to accept that this is the only way. And, you know, whether it's been austerity or the kind of backlash against women's rights or Trump, you know, it's like no matter the evil that's coming, you fight on.
So what have been the highlights then over the last 13 years?
I mean, this is a bonkers job, right? I work in a place that looks like Hogwarts gone wrong, and people think you have a magic wand. But I also have the absolute privilege of working with a community. So I came here thinking I'd be here for 6 months to live with my mum and dad whilst I went back to studying. And fell in love with it, and fell in love with the fact it was the kind of place that people stopped you on the street because they had an opinion and they were going to tell you. They were also going to sell you a pound of bananas, whether you liked it or not. You know, it's an amazing community to be part of and to see it grow. And some things have been good and some things have been bad. And some things like gentrification have just transformed it. I mean, when I first moved to Walthamstow, people were really snotty about it. Now, you know, I met Kirsty Allsop, who's a lovely lady, but my basic message was, please God, don't do any more programs here because you keep putting up the rents and the prices and it's pushing people out of the area.
Yeah, it's like Grand Designs. So when they do that House of the Year, like every year now there's a house in Peckham and we're like, oh no.
Yeah. Well, and I lived in Peckham when I very first moved to London, in off Goose Green, and I absolutely, that's all changed in the way that
exactly the same.
I mean, when I first moved to London, because I didn't grow up in London, you know, I used to, and you know, I try and explain to my staff as well, it was pre having kind of mobile phones with maps and things on, so I used to just get horribly, I remember kind of getting horribly lost in New Cross one night and just kind of walking back from New Cross to Peckham completely, I mean, you know, as an 18, 19 year old, just kind of wandering around various dark streets, you know, it's just a completely different scenario now.
I moved to London in the 1980s and I've always cycled, so I used to sort of cycle everywhere, and that's quite a good way of getting to know your way around and where everything is.
Well, that's what I used to, so when I first moved to London, it was my year out, I had no money, but I was absolutely determined that I was not going to spend a year out, because I'd agreed to do a year out because I thought I was going to fail all my A-levels and wouldn't get into university. I'd need that extra time. And when I didn't fail my A-levels, I rang the university and they went, no, you've got a place next year. So I had this whole year of my life. And I went to volunteer at the Fabian Society and wouldn't take no for an answer. They were like, we can't pay you. I was like, I don't care. I've got nothing else to do. And I was temping. You know, one of the best decisions I've ever made in life was I went to a local FE college for 2 weeks before I moved to London to live in Peckham with a friend of my dad's and learnt to touch type, which meant that when I was temping, I got £2 more an hour than if he sat on reception. And so I used to sit in a temp office off Berkeley Square, hoping that somebody would be sick that day and they would need a typist and earn the money to live in London. And back then, I could earn enough in 3 days to go down the quick save on Peckham High Street, get myself some food, and then spend the rest of my time being around the Labour Party. Because I had no national connections, had no national experience of politics, but I was prepared to make cups of tea and, you know, do stapling and photocopying and stuff envelopes. And I learned a huge amount in that year. But had I not touch typed, I wouldn't have been able to do as much of it. So best, you know, accidentally best decision I ever made.
Yeah. So who are the politicians you've enjoyed working with then? Who's inspired you?
If you had have told my, so I, you know, I was 18, 19, volunteering at the Fabian Society. And I remember ringing my mum and dad and going, because we just had this Saturday conference. And I was like, Mum, Dad, you'll never guess. I made a cup of tea for Neil Kinnock. And now I am the chair of the Labour Movement for Europe and he's the president of the Labour Movement. And it is a total privilege to sit and listen to him and learn from him and debate with him and laugh with him. He's just as you imagine. And, you know, my 15-year-old self is bowled over by it. Equally, sometimes there are people, I do a lot of cross-party work now and I do work in the House of Lords. And there are people there and they're, you know, they're people, again, from my childhood who were absolute bogeymen and women, but are fascinating to talk to because they were Conservative government ministers. I mean, I do a lot with Lord George Young now, who you might remember as a bicycling baronet. Frankly, I think he's more left-wing than me, you know. But he's fascinating to talk to and it's really interesting and it's a really good lesson in how you make change happen. And, you know, that you can't just talk to everyone who agrees with you. You've got to talk to people who disagree with you. You've got to be willing to stress test your ideas. You've got to be willing to persevere. You've also got to be willing to accept that sometimes you might be wrong or you're not going to win that argument. And in 13 years, you know, that's been both a highlight and a frustration. So I'm really proud to have been part of a number of campaigns, you know, whether it is killing Wonga and the payday lenders or getting abortion rights in Northern Ireland, or the work we're doing now on childcare funding and making misogyny part of our hate crime framework. And it really teaches you that, you know, the thing that makes me sad now is how easily and how quickly a lot of the younger campaigners I work with give up. And they just say, well, you know, these people, they'll never understand. And you think, no, you've got to keep talking because the most powerful thing you can do is be persistent. It's that phrase, isn't it? Nevertheless, she persisted. That's what's so powerful about it. And in 13 years, whether it's, you know, some very, very localized issues and local pieces of casework, you asked me what I'm proud of. It took 8 years to get the man who had raped 4 women and murdered another one in my constituency extradited from India because nobody else cared, but we never gave up. And he got extradited and he was sentenced last year. And, you know, being able to finally say to the murdered woman's family, we've got it, we've got justice for Michelle, was extraordinary. And that is persistence in the same way that also when we first started talking about abortion rights in Northern Ireland during the Brexit debates, I had, you know, very senior people saying, oh, Stella, you're going to ruin your career talking about this women's stuff. Don't be silly. You know, and now it has taken longer than we wanted it to. But women in Northern Ireland have the most progressive abortion rights of all women in the UK, which gives me a deep pleasure whenever I talk to the DUP.
So just can you say, kind of talking about young people coming into politics and how they are, what advice would you give, particularly to women? I think kind of like, I mean, it's tougher, isn't it, for women, I think.
Absolutely. And so people ask me this a lot, and they also ask me a lot to talk about kind of the grief I've had. And it's like, yeah, absolutely. But I don't want to normalise that this is what it's like. The thing I do think is really important, the one piece of advice I have started to give to women, is don't get sidelined into events. And actually, that's across all political parties. You know, men do strategy and policy, women do making cups of tea in events. Now, don't get me wrong, when I was 18, making cups of tea allowed me to be in the room to soak up what was happening and who was talking about things and how they were bashing ideas out. But now I see all too often women get put into politics and they get shunted into either what people think of as lady issues. So, you know, I'm really proud that, I mean, I've taken lots and lots of brickbats for talking about motherhood and for talking about childcare. But we are changing that debate now from being a lady issue to being an economics issue, which is where it always should have been, because you've got millions of women out of work or not able to fulfill their potential because we haven't got affordable childcare in this country. What happens is that or women get told that they're really good at organising things. So, yeah, you can run a brilliant event. And it's like, no, women have ideas and those ideas need to be equally heard. So my big advice to lots of young women in politics right now is don't let anybody tell you that your ideas aren't equally as good or bad as the young men's. And don't let anybody tell you that your role is to make the cups of tea only. Everybody should make tea. Although they probably shouldn't do what I used to do when I was temping, which is put a little tiny, tiny bit of washing up liquid in there to make sure they never ask me again.
I know, I read some, just on that subject, I read something recently that said women are, oh, actually, what it was, it started with a quote from Obama who said something like, if we had female leaders for 2 years, the world would really change. That's sort of like really misquoting what he said there. But if we could have an experiment where every country on earth had a woman in charge for 2 years, it would really change things and move, shift things in a better direction.
I definitely think it would be different. I also know that as soon as those women moved on, we'd go back to countless articles about, well, can women have it all? And, oh, are they really able to cope? Because one of the things I've also come to realise in 13 years is just how powerful backlashes are. So you think about Jacinta Ardern saying, do you know what? I've done my time. I want to move on. And immediately there were loads of articles about, does this mean that women can't have it all? Her predecessor did exactly the same thing. But because it was a man, nobody said, does this mean that men really can't cope with the cut and thrust of politics? You know, and the backlash is as powerful as the progress that you make. So you have to keep your foot on the pedal constantly. I remember when I first got elected, one of the first debates I took part in was about anonymity for rape victims. And I was puzzled. I sort of thought, haven't we won this argument? The truth about progress and the truth about equality and justice is that you never really win the argument. You move it forward so that it's much harder when that backlash comes to push things back. But you've always got to keep pushing. And it's you know, very, very clear in the conversations we're having now about women's rights and inclusivity, you know, things that when I first got involved in politics, nobody batted an eyelid about are now being contested when it comes to equality. And it's a backlash and we should call it that. And we have to mobilise accordingly. Now, within that, it doesn't mean that you can't talk to people who you disagree with. I do a lot of work locally, for example, with my local churches on issues around refugees, but they're the same people who've come to me to say, look, we don't agree with what you're doing on abortion. You know, good politics and good democracy allows people to hold competing views and still find places to collaborate. That is not where our politics is right now. And so a lot of that grief that women are getting, particularly women of colour are getting, is coming from a perspective of the backlash combined with a temerity to speak up in the first place. And it's about shouting people down rather than because you're frightened they might have a point.
I know. Well, I do wonder about a kind of like with the women politicians, like, or leaders rather, Jacinda Ardern and Nicola Sturgeon as well. Though that seems to be kind of, there are other issues going on there at the moment. But I was kind of like, are women more honest than men about kind of saying they've given it everything and, you know, that's it, no, you know, no more in the tank kind of thing, where men, for example, Boris Johnson, Trump, you know, carry on regardless and refuse to leave. Oh, I just wondered, are women more honest?
No, because I think actually my experience of speaking up about trying to be a mum of very young children in politics is it was women who were particularly hostile to me and sort of said, you know, we all struggled, just get on with it. Don't make us out to be victims. I mean, there was more of a pressure to not be honest about how difficult it was from women than it was from men. And I think you see that where my male colleagues, if they walk around with their babies, everyone says, what a great dad. And, you know, if a woman does, it's like, oh, God, she's acting like she's the first one who's ever had a baby and, you know, just attention seeking. I don't think we can generalize. I mean, look, I think this is healthy. You know, I'm a goodness knows what wave of feminist I am. 3.5, you know, crippling, past Agatha Christie, but before you get to Zendaya, I don't know. But, you know, we are moving into a healthier space where we don't expect all women to have had the same experiences all the time or to agree all the time. And I think that's important because we never expect that of men. I mean, it's like when people say to me, oh, did Margaret Thatcher inspire you? And I'm like, I don't know, did Silvio Berlusconi inspire you? It's an equally odd question to me. But we haven't yet recognised that still there are category errors made about being a woman that mean that systematically your gender, along with your race, along with your disability and social class, becomes a reason why people count you out rather than bring you in. And until we get to that point where we're thinking, actually, diversity within groups of people is just fascinating because it means we all get better. You know, you want to talk about the Obama quote. I mean, lots of women are, you know, pretty sure Hillary Clinton said something similar. Yeah. Of course, once a man says it, we all recognize it as important. But, you know, the countries that have more diversity in their leadership, in the same way the companies who have more diversity in their leadership, are more resilient and more successful. And if we've seen anything, you know, we've been through some massive, scary changes in the UK in the last 10 years, you know, pandemics and Brexit and referendums and the rise of the far right, all those sorts of things. The countries that we are competing with that are more diverse are the ones that are coming through stronger. And it's learning that lesson that actually it holds us all back. It's not about being nice to women. It's not about, oh, look, Hillary, let's have you in the room because it would be great. It's about the fact that you have a when, you know, people bring different experiences to the table, they spark off each other. So actually men are missing out on how they could be better if they were challenged by more diversity and experiences too. And we never talk about equality like that. We always talk about it's about like doing a favor for the voices that aren't in the room rather than saying, you know what, the room's got a bit flaccid. Let's liven things up and see where we get somewhere better.
Good point. So what are you working on currently?
All sorts of things. So the childcare stuff has absolutely become more center point in politics, and that's great. But the risk at the moment is that the money that we need to actually make affordable childcare work in the UK and therefore make it cost neutral, ironically, isn't there. So the risk is that you've increased demand, but you haven't increased supply. So this government could end up crashing our childcare system just like it crashed the economy, because people think, great, well, I can get places. And the nurseries are like, we can't afford to do this. So I'm doing a lot of work on childcare reform still, because it's about both where the money should come from and what it should be spent on. As a mother of a child who's under two, who doesn't get any subsidy at the moment, it's always seemed bonkers to me that the subsidies are kind of defined by age, because it's not like I can put my son in a kind of in a drawer in my office and forget about him right now. You know, he needs childcare, just as my daughter, who is over three, who does get subsidy, does too. I'm doing a lot of work on migrant rights and refugees. You'll have seen that the government is posting up all sorts of people to blame for why the world isn't a good place right now. And one of those groups is refugees. It makes absolutely no sense at all what they're doing. It will mean that more people will come in boats. It means that there will be more trafficking because they're not actually going after the traffickers. They're failing to understand the people who are travelling, who are on the whole refugees. And when you assess them, they are entitled to sanctuary. You can't do any of that on your own as a country. So the other thing I am is I'm chair of the Labour Movement for Europe. I'm doing a lot of work on what a new relationship with Europe should look like, because our country was already in decline prior to Brexit, but Brexit was like driving a great big hole in the bottom of your boat and going, carry on, it'll be fine. And we're taking on water. You know, our productivity is down, our trade relationships are down, opportunity is down. Now, to recognise that isn't to say, right, so let's just go back into the European Union. Frankly, the European Union have had 7-8 years of us being total pains. They wouldn't have us. But it is to say, can we start to fix the problems that Brexit's created? Because to not do is to basically consign us to being an irrelevant country for the next generation. And I'm not going to do that to the kids in Walthamstow who need the opportunities that come from being able to travel in Europe or work for companies that have bases in Europe or be able to collaborate with their peers across Europe. So I'm doing a lot of work on that, especially in the run-up to the likely general election next year.
And so, I mean, the state of things right now, we were talking a bit about how everything's broken, we've had Brexit, you know, the junior doctors are on strike this week. I can't book an Avanti West Coast train in advance if I want to go and see my mom in Blackpool, you know, everything.
If you use online booking, you'll get offered Klarna. And having beaten the payday lenders, my new bet noir is the buy now, pay later lenders, the Klarnas, the Clearpay, who are driving people into debt again, and the government is dragging their feet on regulating them, and they're really dangerous. And one of the lessons about all of that, like I say, is that it's not that you win an argument and it's done, is that you have to keep fighting, because the backlash comes in all sorts of different ways. And a lot of these companies are just the same sort of attitude about, well, it's fine to exploit people because if they're poor and they've chosen to take out our credit, it's on them. It is really frustrating. Like, I'm not going to tell you that it's great and wonderful and super smashing, and, you know.
But it's going to be tough. If Labour get in next year, I mean, there's a lot that needs fixing.
Totally. And also, I mean, I guess in 1997, I was wide-eyed and excited. I'm still excited now about the possibility of a Labour government, but I'm also much more aware of what can go wrong, frankly, and what can be delayed and what can be, you know, the worst temptations of us all in politics to indulge yourself. It's a very literary Ponzi reference, but I always think of King Lear. And, you know, do you surround yourself with Cordelias, or do you surround yourself with Reagans and Gonerils? And then, you know, accordingly, you end up gouging your own eyes out at the end anyway. It is really easy in this job to go for the path of least resistance, because when I first started doing it in 2010, people at least asked questions before they were angry. Now people are angry, and then they might, if you're lucky, ask you a question about how something has happened. And that's really hard. Like, we get the politics we deserve. If we create an environment where only weirdos who enjoy being shouted at because, you know, they get off on the attention and the controversy and the conflict do it, you don't really want those people trying to figure out what to do with really knotty problems. And, you know, everyone's watched a lot of Netflix, right? They think there's lots and lots of grand conspiracies. If only there were actually big secret plans and everybody knew what was going to happen and it was all being organised in 45-minute segments. Most of politics is a bunch of people who don't really have all the information they need trying to figure out what is possible now. So absolutely, like, I am acutely conscious that getting a Labour government is the start of a conversation, but it's a conversation that needs to keep being sometimes really difficult if you're going to do the big things that you need to do. Like, I look at child poverty that has just shot up again. Like, think back to that point in 1997 when it was like, we're going to end this. And we were making real strides to it. And now it's doubled and, you know, millions of people at food banks and this sort of thing. And you think, we've got to fight really hard just to get back to where we were, let alone to get forward on this. And in the meantime, you know, what else could happen? But my mum's right. It's not about us. It's not about your own sense of fear about these things. It's about what can be done, and have you got a plan, and are you prepared to put the work in? And if you are, change is possible. Like, I wouldn't do this job. I would not be that much of a masochist to do a job where I could just spend all day lounging on green benches, making the same speech three different ways, having a very good, having a very good lunch and feeling terribly important. But frankly, I never wanted to be a GB News presenter. So, other choices are available and change is possible. It's just bloody hard work.
It seems like hard work, particularly like the last few years, all the Westminster psychodramas, the shenanigans, the corruption, the party, you know, if the pandemic, Brexit, I mean, what a shit show.
It is. But it's also the world we live in now, right? And it's, what do we do? So there's a great American trade union slogan, which is don't mourn, organise. Like, it's, you know, absolutely, my mum is right. It's indulgent to walk away and think, well, you know, nothing to do with me, Gov, just because it got harder. Did we think that change was going to be easy? Did we think that the backlash against positive progressive change was going to go, fair play, you've got a hashtag, we're off. Like, that isn't what happens. You know? And winning elections and winning office is part of that process of change, but it's not the end of it. And it's also not the only thing that changes things. So I'm your worst nightmare as your MP, right? Because I always say to people, I can't do anything on my own. We have to do it together. I'm going to have to get you involved in this. Because even if it's writing legislation or something local about fly tipping, like the answers, I believe in the power of collective change. So the idea that, like, once you've come and told me, you've told the customer complaints desk and I'm just going to go off and wave a magic wand and it'll all be better. And, you know, then if it doesn't work, what you need to just do is send a really stiffly tweeted, you know, Facebook post. Like, that is not how change happens. But change can happen. So if it can happen, and the more people you get involved in it, the more likely it is to happen, game on.
Mm-hmm. What would you do if you were Prime Minister for the day? Well, you might, in the future, you might be Prime Minister.
No, look, people always assume that, like, it's all about, you know, wanting a particular role. I mean, I have enjoyed the freedom that comes, frankly, from being able to work with people in all different environments, all different backgrounds. You know, I take my hat off to those people who are prepared to play the system and sit through the meetings. I don't have the patience for it. You know, I call meetings arm chewers, where I would willingly chew my own arm off if I could leave early. So, you know, if you're asking about the issues I'd work on, look, absolutely. One of the big problems in this country right now is the bank of mum and dad, because for too many kids, it's a lack of bank of mum and dad that means they don't have the opportunity to be what they could be. And I'm very selfish. I think Walthamstow is full of the most amazing young people who could do all sorts of incredible things. You think Brian Harvey was the extent of our contributions to the world, or Harry Kane, Fleur East. You haven't met the people around here.
Oh.
They need those chances, right? So they need a government and they need a country that believes in them enough to put some money behind them and to level the playing field. Because right now it's the kids whose parents managed to buy property before Walthamstow went off the scale who have the most chances. And that can't be right, because that's not linked to talent.
No, completely agree with you about that, because I'm from Blackpool. I had a full grant when I was a student, because, you know, grew up in a council house, you know, didn't have a lot of money. I wouldn't be able to do a degree. I probably wouldn't do a degree. I wouldn't move to London. I wouldn't be able to afford the rent. So I completely agree with you on the... Well, kind of like levelling up as well, I think, all round.
Well, that's what makes me so frustrated, because I feel like this government has wanted to pit people against each other, North versus the South. You know, the woke... I live in North London, for goodness sake, you must cut me and I bleed chai latte, obviously. Like, the reality is, across this country, in every single community, there are trans kids. Across this country, in every single community, there are people who are being approached by the far right. There are kids who have potential. Because of where they live, the opportunities to realise that will be different. And absolutely, you have to level that playing field. But you shouldn't say, well, it's North versus South. You should actually saying, actually, nobody gets a free pass here, because everybody's got to pull their weight. So if we're not tapping into your potential and you're not doing something about it, we've got a problem. And that's why I'm part of a national political movement. It's why I don't agree with nationalists, you know, who sort of say, well, if you've got a different passport, that's what makes the most difference. Like, I've got family living in Scotland, and I think the worst thing that could happen to Scotland would be to become independent, because it would make it harder for those young people in Scotland who have that talent to realise it and for us to benefit from it. You know, Chris Hoy was training across the country. He still won a medal for Great Britain, and we were still able to defeat, I think it was the Australians, isn't it, are really good at cycling as well. You know, it's like, I've got ambitions. Lutalo Mohammed is a Walthamstow resident. I haven't yet got my gold post box. I'm working on it. I've told them that's what we want. You know? But if he wins a gold medal, he wins it for Walthamstow and for Great Britain. How brilliant would that be?
Oh, it'd be fantastic. Oh, I love that you are proud of your young constituents.
Well, I love them all, even when they come up to argue with me in Sainsbury's. And I've just bought a shed load of loo roll and feel slightly awkward because I'm holding it, you know. Yeah. You can't do this job if you don't like people or find people interesting and kind of curious. But we also don't have a politics right now that encourages people to collaborate. And, you know, as someone who's left wing, that's much more dangerous than for the right wing, because the right wing can always say, well, we'll just let the market decide things. If you are somebody like me who believes that it doesn't matter how wealthy you are, individually you're never going to be able to achieve as much as you could collectively bouncing off each other, then you've got a problem. People don't want to work together. And that's the hardest thing of all right now is, you know, Brexit in particular made everybody really, really angry and difficult and awkward with each other. And repairing that so that we can actually fix things is really hard.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to, that kind of divisive sort of, it's sort of populist politics. It's kind of everywhere, isn't it? America, obviously.
One of the things I think is really helpful to think about is the concept of malice, right? Because, you know, especially as we all get older, we all realise how obsolete we are. I mean, you know, I love it when I was sort of speaking to some young people the other day who were telling me how awful Friends was, and I sort of think, well, at the time we didn't think that.
Oh, I don't know. I always thought it was a bit smug.
it was smug in a different way. I mean, yeah. The Rachel Hare thing was just mad. But, you know, but that kind of being wise after the event to your own prejudices and your own privileges is a really powerful thing. But I think, and not expecting everybody else to be perfect. Now, that is not an excuse for when you say or do something which cut somebody out, not recognizing it. And I think the concept of malice for me is really important. So I look at people, I look at the kind of cancel idea, and I think, absolutely, canceling is also about accountability, right? If you've said or done something, and we've all done it, and I've done it, where you've hurt somebody because you've been of your generation, or you've not recognized your own privilege, it is right to be accountable. The question for me is malice. And I draw a distinction between those people who actively encourage division and hatred and use it as a weapon from those people who have said or done something that they are then mortified about because they had not thought it through, they had not realized that it was painful and hurtful, the connotations of what they were doing. Because we have to have a capacity in society to be able to differentiate between those people who have never had to come across some of those issues, never had to really, you know, never had to recognise and respect and be kind to somebody else in that way, and people who are deliberately using the power of words and the power of their position to wound and to be malicious. So I look at, you know, I mean, there's a more common or garden term for this, isn't it? Like wind-up merchants. There's a difference, isn't it? Between, I look at presenters and commentators who are doing things for clickbait, who are being provocative, who are using other people as a battering ram to get likes and to promote hatred and to be controversial and to be talked about. And I differentiate them from somebody who doesn't even know where to begin, whether it's, you know, debates around trans rights or racism or, you know, refugees, and who wants to ask questions and is frightened about asking those questions and needs to ask those questions to understand. And I think malice is the thing you have to look for. If somebody comes at something and they are open and willing to recognize that they might be wrong and that they have prejudices that are inbuilt from years of, you know, conditioning or never having to come across an issue, that is different from somebody who, you know, does a Lawrence Fox or a Piers Morgan or a Nigel Farage and is just a wind-up merchant and is using somebody else's life to cause pain accordingly.
Yes, I think kind of like, I don't know, Labour Party need to make more of that. I like that idea because it's kind of, I think, particularly with the sort of media in this country as well, I think maybe people... maybe people are aware, I don't know, of it, you know, that they are, yeah, that kind of that it's being used against them. I don't know.
Well, as somebody who has stuck her neck out on issues, you know, you can, I can spot the person who comes and claims to be the real defender of women's rights, who's completely silent on abortion or childcare or violence against women, but is obsessed with trans women, for example, which is a very sidebar issue compared to, you know, the levels of rape convictions in this country, the systematic, the treatment of black women in our maternity wards, for example, is horrific. And I just sort of gently feel that you can divide between those people who need to ask questions and who are genuinely concerned about an issue, want more information, from those people who are looking for somebody to blame and somebody to create controversy over, because for them, it, you know, it gets them where they need to get to.
And it is a distraction, isn't it? It's distracting. That's sort of the government use it as a distraction to just take people's attention away from, you know, what's really going on.
Well, Well, that's the kind of the culture war stuff, isn't it? And some of that, I think, does tap into that. They say that, I mean, we laugh about Friends, but it is that sense of getting older and more aware of the world. I mean, I think about things that were on telly when I was a kid, and now I'm horrified.
I'm a bit older than you, so some of the things we used to watch as well, you're just like, oh my God.
And, you know, the world is a better place when we're not promoting that rhetoric. I mean, one of the reasons why we've been fighting for misogyny to be part of our hate crime rubric is it's not just the convictions. I mean, none of the things we're talking about, it's not creating any new crimes. It's just recognising where hatred of women is driving violence against them. But also, if you think about racism, we still have systematic and structural racism in this country. And our understanding and awareness of it has changed because we have recognised the harm that it does by recognising it as a hatred. So there are still things on TV about women and depictions of women that I think, my God, you know, if we get this right in 20 years' time, we will look back in the same way we might look at Alf Garnett and go, yeah, no, that's not funny. That's terrifying that he's kind of held up as a hero, even though, you know, Warren Thingy was doing it as a pastiche and a, you know, it was meant to be subversive. I mean, one of the things I think is most important in life to do is not presume that other people can't think, because they can. Like, the idea that you're the only one who can see through what's being presented to you is, I mean, it's kind of where the Soviets got to. But being able to change those debates changes the culture in the country too. And, you know, changing the debate about what is acceptable in terms of how you approach somebody from the opposite sex, you know, that actually, oddly enough, following a woman down the street shouting, get in the back of the van, love, probably won't end in a marriage, is a really forward step to take. Because if you think about a lot of the stuff we've seen on TV and a lot of the culture about, you know, what it is to be a young man, like, it's pretty retrograde in the way that, say, 20, 30 years ago, what was it, Duty Free used to have terrible racial stereotypes in, didn't it? And I used to watch that all the time as a kid. And now I look back and go, my God.
Oh, blimey. Moving things on, I'm going to ask you, I ask all my guests a series of questions. So I'm ask you these, I call them the grown-up guide questions. Okay, so I'm exhausted. How tired are you?
I have two children under the age of four. If I can finish a sentence, I'm doing well.
You're doing very well, Stella, I think. And what do you think the best thing is about getting older?
It was only my birthday a week and a half ago, and I had that slight panic where I realised I'm now in a new box on one of the forms. There's a tipping point, is it? Because I know in 10 years' time, I'll look back on this age and think, what was I worried about? You know, think about that age. And I look back now in my 30s and think, why was I agonising about being in my mid-30s. I think it's that, you know, things go round and round. So the very first time I rebelled in Parliament, I was terrified and I got through it. once you realise that actually people are, you know, it's not the be-all and end-all. It's a bit like heartbreak, isn't it? The first time somebody breaks your heart and you think you're never going to ever recover over it. And then my mum used to say to me, and I used to think, God, it's a terrible thing. So she'd say, someone's going to come along that's going to hurt you even more. Oh. And I'd be like, oh, God. But she was right. She was right. You know, you think you feel really strongly about this person, you wait till you meet the next. And she was right. Oh. So, I think the thing about getting older is that you can see that things move on in a way that possibly when I was younger, I thought everything was like, if it didn't happen then, that was it.
What are you reading right now? Do you have time to read?
No, I'm terrible. I have not read properly. And I am embarrassed about how little I've read since I got, and that wasn't, it's nothing to do with having kids, it's to do with being elected. I can, however, probably tell you the entire back catalogue of Netflix and Amazon Prime and Disney, because I have watched a huge amount of trash TV.
Great. That's my next question. What are you watching right now?
I mean, if it's trashy, I've worked my way through it. Even down to like the Italian teen dramas on Netflix when I was with my first child, kind of late at night up feeding. I do all the kind of, I love a good murder mystery. If in another lifetime, I would write murder mystery novels. So I love Ian Rankin and Agatha Christie and
Have you watched Magpie Murder?
I've just got one more episode to go.
I've only watched one. I've only seen one episode. So I need to, but I enjoyed it. And I love Leslie Manville. So I need to go back to that.
I'm always a bit mixed because I love the Aurelio Zen novels, but I thought the adaptations were pish. So I'm always a bit wary of adaptations. I think the Unforgotten stuff is extraordinary.
That's so brilliant.
So well written and so well observed.
I love that. And the changing of the character, the lead detective.
Yeah, Sonny yeah. Hanging to his own has just worked
brilliantly as well.
I'm not a great fan. I haven't actually got into Succession. I know everyone's banging on about it, but I didn't really get into it. I mean, it took me a while to get into Game of Thrones. Frankly, the only reason I got into Game of Thrones is because I was so offended that my partner, who was serving in Afghanistan at the time, watched more of it than I had. And it's one of the few things in our relationship, you know, if you cheat on me with telly, that is it. Like, so the fact that he'd started watching it without me meant that I sort of was determined I was going to catch up with him so that when he came back, he couldn't watch it again without me. I also have like a penchant for the really terrible schlockies, things like Love is Blind and, you know, all the things on Netflix where actually you could probably watch the whole thing in an hour if they weren't dragging it out so long.
I've just started watching Beef on Netflix.
Oh, I've seen, yeah.
Quite enjoying that. That's quite good, yes.
Yeah, that's on the list. I mean, I do promise you, I do a lot of work. Like, I probably work 80-hour weeks, 89, but I need to decompress.
Yeah, you need the crap TV to sort of wind down.
Trash TV. I mean, also because it's become much more precious since we've had kids, because the kids just dominate. So if you wanted to ask me about Sarah and Duck and Bluey and Dougie and Rainbow Ruby and, you know, like all of these things, which obviously when I was a kid, we couldn't watch things repeatedly.
Favourite food and drink?
Oh, well, I have to say my mum's spag bol. Because like that is my comfort go-to food, and is it like especially so? When I was pregnant with my second child, I got gestational diabetes, which means I now spend all my time trying to avoid getting actual diabetes. Which means that the concept of eating pasta is a real treat for me now because I very rarely eat it. So if I can have my mum's spag bol, that is my absolute favourite.
Okay, I wanted to ask you as well because we talk about style quite a lot on That's Not My Age. So talk me through your outfit.
Those are my terrified questions because it's bad enough. Like being an MP, the other thing about it is it's like it's basically like you're everyone's head teacher. Like nobody wants to take you down the pub. Everyone's always slightly awkward when they see you in the street. They don't feel like they can fully relax with you. And in style terms, my absolute terror is feeling like I'm dressing like a geography school teacher. And I apologise to all geography school teachers listening to this. Because if I could, I would just wear Converse and jeans and hoodies all day long and be comfy. Today I'm wearing a woolly dress and boots. I also have the worst feet in the universe. I have the ugliest feet in the universe. They're completely flat. They've got bunions. I cannot wear heels to save my life. I get told off in Parliament all the time for my footwear. It's like being an air hostess. It's massively inappropriate.
What are the dress codes in Parliament?
Well, that's interesting because there isn't a dress code for women because they've never had enough women to think they needed one. So it's entirely dependent on who is on the chair and their own predilections.
So you can wear trainers?
Well, except that you then they exercise ultimate control by not calling you to speak if they don't approve of how you're dressed. And they, we were told we couldn't wear slogan t-shirts. So I've sat in Parliament wearing various slogan t-shirts and been told off.
Catherine Hamlet
has gone quite backwards on a number of things, whether it is refusing to have women who have children in there or dress codes. Say, I'm also fighting middle age and fighting that sense of like...
Not fighting, embrace it, Stella, embrace it.
I've never looked good in a pantsuit, right? My colleagues, so Zara has the most gorgeous pantsuits and she always looks amazing in them, Zara Sultana, and I've always complimented her on them. And then, but there are others like Siobhan McDonough is just amazing with, she wears lots of very beautiful colours and beautiful jewels. And she always looks incredible whenever I see her. And I always sort of feel like I've got that flustered geography school teacher, slightly rosy faced, hoping it's not too crumpled, flat shoes and trying not to be dressed like I got dressed in the dark. I mean, I love fashion, but I'm rubbish at it.
I think you look all right. I've seen lots of photos of you looking pretty cool.
Well, in my defence as well, the cameras in Parliament are at such an angle that nobody ever feels comfortable. Like you look an odd shape, and then you're sort of acutely aware of, you know, the side eye ones as well.
But also, I am aware that kind of women are unfairly judged, aren't they? It's always like, what, you know, people commenting about, I don't know, say Theresa May's leopard skin shoes or whatever it is. It's kind of like, men don't get that, I think. Well, maybe they do. Boris Johnson's hair.
My male colleagues can look a state and everyone just thinks that's charming. You know, I know that my female colleagues are all terrified of being judged on what they wear. And it's so annoying. And also then it kind of manifests itself in other ways. So some people go for what you might call wacky and you think, no, just like relax.
Yeah. I think under the radar cool is sort of a better approach, isn't it?
There's a very lovely local woman who runs a shop here called Glow, and I go and I see her and she's got really beautiful pieces in that I sort of feel are the right side of not being, you know, Miss Marple. I mean, actually, Miss Marple would be very cool, but but also not, you know, of a certain length or requiring a high heel, because as I say, high heels are just a non-starter for me. Jo Elvin does an amazing thing on Instagram every week where she does a kind of what she's going to wear in the week ahead. And I'm just obsessed with, she has the most amazing flat shoes. And I, you know, I have rules for the revolution requires us to be able to dance. It requires us to be able to eat. You can't make good decisions when you're hangry. And it requires us to be able to wear flat shoes.
So what kind of are your favourite feel-good clothes? And when do you kind of like, when you're kind of away from, I don't know, the limelight and you...
I have just recently discovered what they call mum jeans.
They come up. Are they the ones that sort of like come up higher at the waist?
They do come up, but they're also then they're kind of wide, sort of not quite wide leg, not flares, but sort of wider at the bottom. So they work quite well with boots.
I do quite like the higher waist. I think kind of tucking everything in. Not your jumper, but like kind of like just some jeans that come up higher. I always think quite flattering.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, and also, like, if you're, you know, and if you have hips, then having jeans that cut into them is not comfortable. And actually, when you're speaking in Parliament is a terrifying experience. And it doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. I mean, I remember when I first got elected, watching David Blunkett panic. Well, he wasn't panicking. He was nervous. And I remember being so relieved by that because I thought, my goodness, if somebody of such stature as David still feels the nerves at getting up to speak in Parliament, then it's kind of okay for me to be terrified about doing it. And you have in your head Davina McCall, like, this is live, please do not swear. But you also have, am I going to have a time limit? Am I going to say everything needs to be said? Am I going to lose my place? Am I going to be able to do it in a way that isn't gabbling? I mean, you can hear that I'm somebody who, I don't do slow because you're thinking that quickly. The last thing you want to be doing is wearing clothes. And I'll be very upfront about this. I've had moments where I've been in Parliament where I've thought, oh, my period's come on. And if you leave the chamber, you lose your place to speak because they don't actually tell you when you're going to speak. So if you're sitting there thinking, I need to go to the toilet, but you're sort of stuck going, what's the trade-off here? So because you're acutely aware that it's all on camera, in the same way that I've had, you know, colleagues of mine have had zips bust and all sorts, and you're sort of trying to shuffle out whilst very aware that these cameras are at very odd angles.
Quite antiquated in other ways as well. Would you say you have a style signifier, something that everyone thinks, oh, that's very Stella?
Not really, but I do have, a couple of necklaces that my mates know that if I'm wearing them, I'm up to something. So I have a plotting...
A power necklace.
No, it's like my best friend, to say this, the same friend who, when we go to the shops together, she gave me a necklace with a little cat on that's winking. And that's my, like, I've got a plan here. So I was wearing that a lot during the abortion stuff in terms of where I was putting pressure on things. And the debate we did about street harassment, I was wearing the necklace that my daughter had made because ultimately in my head it was, you know, it's her generation. I want not to think twice about being able to go where they want to go and do what they want to do and not think, oh God, am I going to get grief for getting on a bus as a young woman? So I had it in my head and her necklace and her bracelet rather as well.
Final question. What's the single most important piece of advice you've ever been given?
Well, I wasn't given it, but actually the single most important piece of advice that plays around my head now every single day was a video I saw by an American senator called Cory Booker. And he's been doing some really interesting stuff about just little snippets of advice and things. And he said, you don't have to show up to every argument to which you're invited. And it really struck a chord with me.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought, and I often think that now. So like a lot of people, I will draft the tweet, I will write the email, and then I don't send it. Because it's cathartic. But, in our current environment, I go back to what I was saying at the start, you know, where everyone's so angry all the time and they're looking for someone to blame and they're looking for confrontation and conflict. And so people are trying to provoke you sometimes because that's kind of what they think politics should be about and what they think makes them relevant. You don't have to show up to every argument to which you're invited. It's a really powerful thing to go, do you know what? Sit in your own plastic box and shout at yourself.
That's a good one. I like it. Don't get embroiled in all that stuff. Oh, Stella, thank you so much for your time. Very much appreciated. I feel like I've got to go out and do something now. I've been spoken to you. Can't sit around moaning about the state of things. I need to get busy and act and...
Well, but you need to have a cup of tea and a biscuit first. Like I say, you never make good decisions about the state of the world if you're hungry.
That's true.
And you need a decent pair of flat shoes. You know?
Definitely. I've got those, got the flat shoes, got the biscuits. We'll have a cup of tea and then I'll get busy. Oh, thank you so much.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed the interview. Please come back soon. And it'd be absolutely brilliant if you could review the podcast on iTunes and also on thatsnotmyage.com. I know that sounds like a lot, but I would appreciate it very much. And don't forget, it's not about age, it's about style.